Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Channel. Today we're here to discuss the treatment of atrial fibrillation. We'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank Sanofi Aventis for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoverychannelcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, and I encourage you to check it out today. We're fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio with us today to talk about atrial fibrillation. Dr. Cynthia M. Tracy, Professor of Medicine, Associate Director, Division of Cardiology, George Washington University Medical Center, Washington, D.C. Dr. Mike Mangrum, Associate Professor of Medicine, Director, Atrial Fibrillation Center, University of Virginia Health System, Charlottesville, Virginia. And Dr. Michael D. Izekovitz, Professor of Medicine, Jefferson Medical College, Attending Cardiologist, Lankenau Medical Center, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Doctors, thank you all for being with us here today. During the next hour, we plan to do the following: describe what is known about the epidemiology and outcomes of atrial fibrillation, emphasizing the seriousness of the condition. We'll outline current recommendations for atrial fibrillation treatment with emphasis on recent guideline updates. Incorporate new evidence, treatment approaches, and recommendations in considerations of rate versus rhythm control. Select appropriate agents for rhythm control in patients with atrial fibrillation. And improve communication with patients about atrial fibrillation and identify ways to encourage adherence to treatment. So let's start with the basics. Just how common is atrial fibrillation, or AFib as it's commonly known?
Well, atrial fibrillation is an epidemic today in our society as our patient population ages. It's a very important condition because it's associated with increased mortality, a higher incidence of strokes, impaired quality of life, and patients are more likely to develop heart failure if they have atrial fibrillation. So it is very important for all of us to understand this condition very well.
And I would add that as the population ages over the next several decades, we're likely to see a greater prevalence of atrial fibrillation in our society. Would you agree?
I think that's true. That's absolutely correct.
In fact, it's estimated by the year 2050, there'll be about 16 million Americans with atrial fibrillation, which is an amazing statistic, really.
Can you remind our viewers of the different types of AFib and the physiologic effects?
Yes. Atrial fibrillation can be categorized into categories based upon the time course of their AF episodes. For instance, some patients have what is termed paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, and that is defined as episodes that last less than 7 days that spontaneously terminate. There's also another category called persistent atrial fibrillation, and these episodes are episodes of AFib that last longer than a week or require a shock or cardioversion to come out. And then there's a third category called permanent atrial fibrillation. And in these patients, the episodes run continuously, and attempts at trying to restore normal rhythm have been unsuccessful. So in general, there are three broad terms or categories for patients: paroxysmal, persistent, or permanent.
There is also the category of patients that have lone atrial fibrillation. These are generally younger individuals who have atrial fibrillation, usually paroxysmal, and do not have structural heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, and are otherwise generally well. These patients have an excellent prognosis, but tend to be very symptomatic.
Yes, I think it's important. It may sound like a lot of words, paroxysmal, persistent, but it really is important in terms of how we manage the patient. What's appropriate for a patient with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation wouldn't be appropriate for somebody with permanent atrial fibrillation. So kind of categorizing these things this way helps us understand what the treatment options are for the patient.
Over the past few years, we have learned more about the outcomes associated with untreated and undertreated AFib. Talk a little bit more about some of those outcomes.
I think it's very important that we do keep the outcomes in mind. The biggest thing that we're always concerned about in undertreated patients is the possibility of stroke. And depending on the risk category of the patient, there may be a higher risk of stroke. Some patients may face up to 8% risk of stroke per year, sometimes even higher. So it's critical for us to, as we evaluate patients, to determine what their risk of stroke is. There's a host of other complications that can arise. There can be dysfunction of the heart muscle related to the very rapid heart rates. It does affect the overall prognosis a person has. Being in atrial fibrillation can increase mortality. A lot of the prognosis of atrial fibrillation is determined by what condition the heart muscle is in, but independently, AFib does connote a negative prognosis.
So just to expand on the stroke problem, as Cindy pointed out, you can define what the patient's risk of developing a stroke is based on the CHADS scoring system. And the CHADS scoring system is a numeric system that was developed by Gage and colleagues many years ago. And basically, if you're over the age of 75, you get 1 point. If you're diabetic, you get 1 point. If you're hypertensive, you get 1 point. And if you've had a previous TIA or stroke, you get 2 points. And the higher the number, the higher the risk. So that anticoagulation is generally advised if you have a CHADS score of one or greater, based on very new data that has come from the RELY trial.
And I would just add that as we, and we'll talk about this probably a little more later, about rate and rhythm control, the stroke prevention and the risk assessment based upon CHADS score is independent. And I think that would be a point to stress, is that it's independent of the rate or rhythm strategy that you choose for the patient. They're two separate issues.
Dr. Mangrum, in the past, AFib has not always been aggressively treated. Why is that?
Well, atrial fibrillation is a very complex disorder. It's complex because the mechanism of the atrial fibrillation may be different for the patient. That's one. The patient's symptoms range anywhere from being asymptomatic to highly symptomatic. So that's another. The third, the treatment options that we have, they're not all perfect, and there are different strategies to treat, whether it's with medications, whether it's with ablation, whether it's with devices. So it's a very complex disorder, and there are many treatment options. And so I think that contributes to the undertreatment of AFib.
Well, just to further expand on that, you know, the rate versus rhythm strategy is fundamental to the approach of the patient with atrial fibrillation. And there have been a number of clinical trials that have looked at comparing the strategy of rate versus rhythm control. And these trials indicate that there is no mortality benefit in rhythm control. However, there is a benefit in terms of quality of life and probably reduced hospitalization and other outcomes that may point to a rhythm control strategy being better than a rate control strategy in selected patients. And again, to emphasize, the care of the patient with atrial fibrillation has to be individualized.
I think that's true. And I think the other thing about AFib that makes people less aggressive about management is that it is so common That it just, you know, people sort of take it for granted. Oh, everybody has palpitations. And they don't kind of get to the root of it, look at the causes for it, and really identify what needs to be done. So I think there's just kind of dismissing it that, oh, these things happen. So I think it's just something that patients and physicians have to keep in mind. You have to dig into it a little bit and see, is this something that's annoying or is this something that's dangerous? So it really, it needs to be looked into.